Lifestyle matters. It's more than money.
I'm Faisal Carmelli, my co-host here, Dave Popowicz. How you doing, buddy?
Great. Good weekend. Doing fantastic. Crazy soccer games. We're going to watch some more. It's going to be a good weekend.
It's been 6 months. I've been clean.
Clean of?
I haven't gone on WebMD for 6 months. Isn't that good? I think that's a good thing. I think, you know,
Where did that come from? What are you talking about?
So with things that are going on in my personal life, just in regards to like family members, illnesses, and so forth, you start looking up stuff, and I'm like, I searched some of these concerns, well, medical concerns that some family members are having, and it actually tells you on your Google search, when was the last time you looked at this?
Yeah.
6 months, WebMD.
Wow.
That's pretty good. I've stayed away from, you know, messing around with my brain on the different things that could happen potentially from a medical perspective.
Good for you.
For 6 months. I am clean.
Good for you.
No program was
you
needed.
You realize you're not a doctor now? And well, you can't interpret the data accurately, yes?
Yeah, well, yes. And I reduced my extreme thoughts from cold or cancer in the same report. I haven't had to worry about those
right.
things.
You know, we're going to talk about that because I think that's a cool segue in interpreting data in our markets, yeah. right? It's the same thing. So, hey, congratulations, by the way.
6 months clean.
I don't think that really benefits anybody very often. We've got a pretty good lineup today. We're going to talk to David Fingold a little bit about markets, the volatility, how to position, what the different scenarios look like going forward.
And if you don't know who Dave Fingold is, he's one of the highest ranked portfolio managers in the country,
yep.
Has done very well over the long term, very disciplined his approach. We've had the opportunity and the pleasure to work with him over a decade now. And I think this is a gentleman that you want to get his insight on how he sees the world
yep.
and how he sees the opportunities to make money. He's done a great job, so why not learn from some of the best?
Let's talk about interpreting data, because I think it's been an interesting week. In fact, I would say started maybe last week in terms of interpreting data and how different people do it. And what I'm speaking about here
not is... WebMD.
Not WebMD.
Okay.
No. But it can be just as confusing, and sometimes the catastrophic thinking can kick in. But
sure.
you know what's interesting is we're in an environment now, Faisal, as you know, where good economic news can be interpreted as bad news. Right, and bad news can be interpreted as good news. And the reason for that is because the central banks are trying to take some of the demand out of the system. So we need to see things slow down. Normally, when economies slow down, that's not good, right? We want things to grow. Okay, so we're in this weird environment where sometimes the opposite, you know, it means the opposite of what you might normally interpret it as. So Friday's trading action in the morning, I thought, was a good example of this, right? So inflation clearly is a focus for the market. We got some data on what would be considered wholesale inflation information in the United States. So the people that produce the goods that we buy, what's inflation look like for them? Because that often gets passed along in the value chain. Okay. So the market was anticipating that the wholesale inflation number would fall to 7.2%.
Okay.
And the number we actually got was 7.4%. And so this was fascinating. The futures markets went from positive to pretty deeply negative. Okay, and then the first hour of trading is always interesting. What I was talking about in the media in the morning is it will be fascinating to watch the market, not just on Friday, but over time, interpret this data through a lens that is either a glass half full or a glass half empty. And depending on how you see that, has inflation fallen, which is positive? Did it fall enough? No. Well, that's negative. How do we interpret this data? And we're in an environment that's going to be very sensitive to that kind of interpretation for the next maybe couple quarters.
So let me go back to my WebMD analogy.
Mm-hmm.
If anybody has been touched or impacted because of cancer, every time you go back for a test, what you feel inside of you about the uh-oh, what could happen? What could go wrong? That is exactly what the markets are feeling right now.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to have more data coming in next week for inflation. We're going to have more data come in with regards to what the central bankers wants to do. Uh-oh.
Mm-hmm.
It's like going in to see, how is this problem of cancer happening? Is
right.
it? Are we progressing positively or negatively? And people will react emotionally, in a health scare like cancer, they're doing the same thing in the markets. And so I think when we look at what's really happening is we're just waiting to find out, A, what the test is, B, what's the results of the test, and then where do we go from here? All that uncertainty in that time frame just lets people, markets, traders, algorithms veer off on the edges of extreme viewpoints.
Right.
That's part of the reason why I said, you know, 6 months WebMD free, mm-hmm. for some people that's a funny comment I'm making, but that's a big step for people who look at that, that platform on an ongoing, on a regular basis and go, oh my God, what could happen?
Yep.
This is what's happening in the market. So I think when we look back and go, okay, what are the possible outcomes? And we've talked about this. What's the worst case scenario?
Mm-hmm.
Let's use the doomsday mentality,
yep.
which is going to be all around the media, mm-hmm. especially on the fringes.
Mm-hmm.
We're going down by 50, 60, 70%,
right.
Dave.
Right.
All the way to, this is all overblown. It's, you know, we're going to the moon.
And everything in between.
And everything in between.
You bet.
So I think this is, if we can think of it like an individual who's going to go back to find out how the cancer is. Is it progressing? Is it not? Are we in remission? Is it benign? What's going on?
Right.
These are the words that we'll be using in the markets as well.
Yeah.
And so I think if we get comfortable around that and proper portfolio construction will allow you to wear that. What you're going to hear from many of our peers in the industry is just hang in there. Hold on. Don't worry. Ride it out. It may be rough at the beginning. It'll be better in the later half, whatever, and so forth. It's just making people sit.
Right.
And I don't know if that's the right strategy, given all the things of risk that could happen.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, listen, I agree. And we, you know, we talk about structure and discipline all the time and the different pillars. And so it's not just about one market either. Remember, when we say market, when people say market, it often just refers to whatever stock market they happen to be looking at that time.
Correct.
And that one stock market doesn't represent all stock markets. It doesn't represent all stocks. It doesn't represent the bond market, the alternatives market. Right? The pillars, the structure, the discipline, all that becomes really important in protecting yourself on the downside, but also profiting when things turn.
And when you look at, I think Canadians, we get slapped across the face with multiple pieces of information. And yeah. I use that terminology with intent. We will watch something on TV or listen on the radio, read something on print, and it could be about one type of market.
Correct.
Let's say the U.S. stock market. U.S. stock market's overvalued, and that's it. That's the end of the world.
Right.
Forget the fact that there's a whole bunch of other nations that have stocks that are trading on their own markets and exchanges that are better value.
And listen, within the U.S., it might be referring to an index, not individual securities.
And here's what I find very interesting. If you ask every single chief investment officer, every single analyst about their pessimistic view on the U.S., and you ask them, does that mean you're not investing in the U.S. at all? None of them. And I say none of them have said, we're 0% in U.S.
Right.
We just think it's overvalued. They will give you their viewpoint. The way it looks or seems on the media is, oh my God, this is the end of the world.
Right.
Way overpriced. But then where do they put their money? Is it where their mouth is or where their actual mind is? Because if you believe the U.S. is done, it's way overvalued, it's going to go 50% to the negative, I'd like to meet the chief investment officers, the analysts, the economists out there that are saying, don't put a dime in that area.
Right. Or don't be long any U.S. security, any stock, yeah. any company. Yeah, doesn't happen, right?
There are points in time where they're just referencing volatility.
Correct. We've had a lot of volatility this year. Markets, depending on which one you're looking at, have been all over the place this year. How do we make sense of this and how do we position going forward, I think, is an important part of the conversation. And we've got a terrific guest. You alluded to this at the top of the hour. David Fingal is joining us, a recurring guest. And he's had a wonderful long time track record with a terrific discipline in investment discipline. I think we're very fortunate to have him. Give us his insights as to where we are and where we're going.
Yeah, we're joined by David Fingal, Vice President and Senior Portfolio Manager with Dynamic Funds. David, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Maybe we can start with that introductory comment that I made, David. There's people have experienced a tremendous, or investors have experienced a tremendous amount of volatility this year. Maybe we'll just get your comments on the source of the volatility that we've seen so far, and then a little bit about your insight in that volatility going forward.
Look, I think that the most important thing that I can communicate is that investing is not easy. I think it can be much easier for an investor when they work with an advisor, but it's still not easy. You know, I remember being at the Berkshire Hathaway annual meeting maybe 10 or 15 years ago, and someone asked Mr. Buffett what to expect from markets. And I think he said to expect around 7 or 8%, but he said not in any given year, and for all the numbers to be extremely different than 7 or 8%. So we're going through one of those kinds of years where the numbers are extremely different. You know, the alternative guaranteed investments only guarantee some low interest rate that over time is almost always lower than the rate of inflation. So you have a difficult choice, which is to be guaranteed to lose money after inflation, or to work with an advisor and to have a plan and to have a chance of growing your assets after inflation. And we were just thrown one of those years where advice from an advisor, patience, and a mature attitude from an investor are very important. You know, I was taught, and I graduated from business school almost 35 years ago, I was taught that the first interest rate hike is not the one that gets you, it's the last interest rate hike. And every once in a while we find out the things we learned are not always right. So the Fed had not even begun hiking this year, and things became very uncomfortable for everybody within the markets. What ended up happening was we had probably the largest interest rate increase that anybody has ever experienced. And the reason why I say it is I think the people are confused. They say, oh, rates went up 3% or something like that. And they don't understand that because of the duration formula, that that's actually a huge amount when your starting point is a very low starting yield on 10-year government bonds. The losses in the government bond market in the United States tied the record from 1 year during the 19th century. So when I say nobody's experienced it, the answer is because the last group of people who experienced it have long since passed away. And that's reverberated through capital markets. The other thing you've had happen is the circumstance geopolitically, which has been frustrating to have to live through and very shocking, because you saw a situation where a conflict was emerging in Eastern Europe. And it was the kind of conflict that historically we would deal with through negotiation. Our partners in Europe asked for negotiations and continue to ask for negotiations, but we have yet to enter negotiations. So at the same time that we had that interest rate mayhem, we had geopolitical mayhem. We ended up going through a first half where actually we were perhaps in technical recession in the United States. Real growth was negative two quarters in a row. And the stock market reacted the way that it normally would react for a mild recession. So when we are looking at what has gone on this year, we have had almost everything that could go wrong go wrong. So the key thing from our approach was to understand that things were getting frustrating, and as soon as we understood they were becoming frustrating, to take the appropriate defensive measures. And then the other thing, and I think this is the most important point, is that we are focused on the long term, and we also want to capitalize on the opportunities that are created by the volatility within the market. So I'd say right now that what we're balancing on a daily basis is to try to be appropriately conservative, because the things we are all concerned about are not over. They will end. So we also have one eye on the long-term opportunity. And, you know, as the amount of worry begins to decrease, we will move more and more of our focus on the long-term as opposed to the short-term risk management.
So David, let me jump in there in regards to what you're anticipating for the new year now. Now that you've kind of put the landscape up about the volatility and what's really been happening for 2022 primarily, where do you see 2023 going?
Look, flipping the calendar doesn't change anything other than the fact that we're looking at the month of January instead of December on our calendars. So the issues that we are dealing with, like digesting higher interest rates or whether or not we will get a clearer answer from China on Taiwan or a clearer answer from the parties that are involved in the conflict in Eastern Europe about whether or not they will negotiate. These are all matters that are not necessarily going to get divided, get decided as the calendar flips over. But as I consider that we have already lived through over 11 months of this volatility, and that perhaps if we pinpoint the start of this process to the peak in speculation in March of last year, back when we first started to see the damage done to the most speculative parts of the market, like the cryptos and the meme stocks and the SPACs, it suggests that actually we could be 18 months into a process. These corrective processes within markets, we call them technically bear markets, do not last forever. The bull markets are longer, and we've gone through quite a bit of this one. If a recession ended on June 30th of this year, and it looks like the third quarter was positive, then it's possible that the volatility is behind us. It's also very possible, because there have been recessions where you get two negative quarters, then one positive one. It's possible that actually a recession started, and some forecasters, and I'd call it actually consensus, think it could end June 30th, in which case the market will start to look ahead during the second quarter. So I think we're getting near the end of this process. And as you will well know, when you go through a frustrating year, what tends to follow is years that are less frustrating. It's very unusual to string together frustrating year upon frustrating year, because recessions don't last forever, bear markets don't last forever, people take corrective actions. An important point, though, is right now I'm talking about the overall economy, which is starting to improve sequentially because the consumer is no longer as highly taxed on food and energy. Those prices have come down off of high boil, which is why I think we saw the growth in the third quarter as gasoline and food came down. So some things were already getting better. The other thing that I would say is I think the market is already looking forward. I mean, that commodity price spike, I think, helped us all understand we had not properly invested in energy, whether it be traditional fossil fuels, whether it be alternatives, traditional non-fossil fuels like hydro. It was very clear from that oil price spike that we need to do more investment in that space. And you can already see that from energy looking ahead and outperforming. And you can also see the industrials have been outperforming since July, and the focus is around things like automation and energy savings, which is again correcting, I think, the mistakes that were illustrated by the pain we went in the first half. So I think those are just two examples of how the frustration we've already experienced is already leading to new leadership in the markets. We talked about geopolitical risk. And the performance of the defense contractors is clearly showing that the stock market sees that we need to do more spending in that space. And I know that we all wish for peace, but it's difficult to negotiate for peace unless you're in a position of strength. And even longtime holdouts on defense spending like Canada and Germany have now agreed to spend 2% of GDP on defense.
You've got a very long-term track record of success, and there's a discipline behind what you do. Could you maybe share with us a little bit about that discipline and where that discipline is showing you the opportunities are right now?
Certainly. There's two pieces to it. There's the bottom-up investing part of what we do, and earlier I mentioned Mr. Buffett, and yes, I am one of those people. I've been to the Berkshire Hathaway annual meeting 6 times. Now that it's streamed over the internet, I and you can enjoy it from your home. But that whole process of buying good quality businesses that are well-managed, well-financed, with prospects for growth, and taking a long-term view on investing in them is where we're focused. And the other part of it that I think is very important is that we have to divide that focus into two things. You have, when you have companies that are not cyclical, like for instance, when we're investing in healthcare, which is an industry that is not very cyclical, we need to find catalysts and attractive valuation. If we're investing in cyclical businesses, we need to find all of the above, but we also have to take a view on the cycle. We have to decide when things are getting better, and we have to decide when things are as good as they can get. So we have to put all that together into the process, and that's what we do. Earlier I talked a little bit about energy, and that's an industry which up until recently had underperformed for a decade. So it's below its long-term trend. So a lot of the industries that we are looking to are industries that are below their long-term trend. The industries that have really done well over the last few years that are way ahead of their trends. And I think the technology comes to mind, but a lot of us have new technology equipment, new software. We've invested a lot in that space. There are areas of underinvestment that represent opportunities in the cyclicals. And then, as I mentioned, with the more defensive spaces like healthcare, it's a combination of an attractive valuation because they underperformed for about 3 years. And also that there's some companies that have exciting new discoveries. And we're not talking here about emerging companies. There are senior blue chip pharmaceutical companies that have made tremendous discoveries that will improve people's lives. And that's also an area for us to focus on.
So when you look at those areas of opportunity that you talked about below the trend line, there are some like technology, and we can spread that out to different subsectors of that industry beyond technology, because I think that's been given the headline out there that technology is overvalued to many. Are there other areas where you're saying, let's be careful? Or maybe even geographical locations that you're saying be careful? Any that come to on your research?
Our founder, Ned Goodman, talked about how leadership alternates in cycles. So for those of us who are old enough to remember, we'll remember that during the 1990s, the extractive industries, things like oil and gas and mining, did very poorly. And then they did well during the 2000s. Technology did very well in the 90s, and then it took a break in the 2000s. And we know that technology did very well in the 2010s, and right now it appears to be taking a break. In terms of what is, what we're concerned about, there has been a lot of investment in consumer goods. We can see that in almost all the consumer good industries that a lot of demand got pulled forward. In healthcare, which is an area that we really like, there was a lot of investment made in the equipment for producing pharmaceuticals because of the investments made in the vaccine production. And while we do like the companies that are making the discoveries, there's, at least in the short term, an overcapacity of the equipment to produce the drugs. Now, that'll get digested, and maybe next year, the year after, there'll be an opportunity in that area. But right now, we just have to go industry by industry and look at what is below trend. Defense spending is below trend. Investment in oil and gas and mining is below trend. Rail is below trend. I think that last year there may not have been a single locomotive sold in the United States. So these businesses that were not doing well and then the equipment just got older are areas where we think they're going to be on the upswing. Whereas if you look at a lot of the spending we've seen from people who were sheltering in place during the lockdowns and did home improvement and so forth, a lot of demand got pulled forward there. So maybe we need to be a bit more patient before going to those kinds of spaces. And then also we have to be concerned about the COVID beneficiaries. I think that everybody already has the video conferencing software they need, or electronic document signing software that they need, and so forth. Those purchases are being made, and those products are going to get used. But I don't know if those markets are going to grow from here. The other thing we have to be concerned about is whether or not there's been any long-term trends in people's behavior. I will say that the way that the office building owners, the U.S. office REITs, are acting, There is some concern about occupancy. The increasing amount of hybrid work seems to be demanding less office space. And a number of the large American banks are looking for buyers for their commercial real estate portfolios, which suggests that commercial real estate is an area that might have overcapacity because of changed consumer behavior. So unfortunately, we have to analyze everything. We can't just look blindly at fundamentals, and we also can't look blindly at trends because, you know, you could have a trend everybody agrees upon, and that might mean that the companies that benefit from it are already expensive and fully discount a good outcome. So we've got to bring everything together. When you talk about parts of the world, the international markets have really underperformed the United States. It's not surprising. In bear markets, the U.S. has a record of always outperforming. As we transition perhaps towards a bull market as we move through next year, one would expect to see more leadership out of the international markets. But a lot of this has nothing to do with politics. It just has to do with the fact that statistically there's more cyclicals in places like Europe and Japan than there is in the United States. And as the economy finds a floor and starts to move forward after those couple of quarters we had of negative growth, then more money will move towards cyclicals and benefit international markets over the U.S. So my suspicion is that, you know, we need to be slowly engaging in that because, you know, I can see how the economy can, you know, move at a slower pace. But as we start to move into the first and second quarter of next year, we're going to be comparing against the difficulties we had in the first half of this year, which makes it easier to grow as we drive forward. And I think that's one of the things that people forget about when the economy slowed and, you know, you see negative numbers on GDP. They extrapolate it into the future, but then they don't understand if we just had a negative GDP quarter, 12 months later, you have an easy comparison and it's easier to have a positive number. Inventories get cleared out of the system. Business confidence comes back. And it's possible we're already moving towards that growth. But I think that over the next couple of quarters, in the worst case scenario, we will move towards that growth.
Okay. I think we have to probably leave it there. There's lots to digest there, David. Thank you. As always, I think you do a wonderful job of giving us both perspective, discipline, and talking about the analysis that is needed to really properly protect and profit when the times are right.
You know, the one thing that people can take away from David beyond just the information he's provided us is that you can hear the discipline in the approach. Mm-hmm. And when you don't have that discipline, then you're left at the mercy of the market versus a money manager like...
Or guessing.
Versus what you're seeing with David, where he actually has the process. It's not just a linear process of fundamentals only or technicals only or cyclicals only or economic
or one trend,
right? Or geopolitical only. Like we can get pulled into the extremes on those cases.
Yeah.
But look at that approach. I think that's one thing that investors have to understand. And there's an approach to that. There's a discipline. That's what we're going to do. But David, thank you for joining us today.
You're welcome.
We've been joined by David Fingold, Vice President and Senior Portfolio Manager of Dynamic Funds.
We touched on this in our first segment a little bit, my friend, but I want to talk about how do we rescue somebody's retirement if they're feeling, it's not good.
So let me paint the picture. For a while now, when we have volatility like this and people are concerned about their portfolios, their retirement, we always say, A, go get your financial plan done if you haven't got one done.
Yeah.
B, stress test your financial plan. And see how the retirement looks. Now let's go with the people who've actually listened to what we've been saying, and they've done that. Mm-hmm. And it comes back and it goes, you're short. You're not going to be able to reach your income goals or your lifestyle goals that you've painted out for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
Okay. Based on this moment in time. Okay. Now I can tell you what the thoughts are or the reactions of the majority of Canadians. Number one, let's go and go into GIC rates. They're at all-time high. Well, not all-time, they're most recent highs.
Yeah.
Or we've got better interest now than ever in a long time. Let's go and do that instead. That's option one. Option two is, uh-oh, I'm short. Let's pick up the risk on this. Let's put more in the stock market. Let's get, I need bigger returns. I need more money.
They don't say let's pick up the risk. They say let's go chase more returns, don't they?
Fair enough. That's fair. Don't they? That's fair. So, let's go chase more return.
Yeah.
And intrinsically, people in our industry say, well, if you're looking for bigger returns, you have to be comfortable with bigger risk.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is where the problem lies.
Right.
Is that the majority of Canadians are going to one extreme or the other. And our industry are order takers. I need to make more money in my portfolio. And then our peers in the industry will come back and say, here you go.
Right.
You asked for this. Here's what you want. Are you comfortable with that? Be higher potential risk. And when you're in the emotion of this, that you have to catch up. Yeah. Just put it in there.
Right.
I just need more money. And you're saying with this will give me more money? Then give it to me. Without understanding the issue of the one part of the biggest equation you'll need going forward through your retirement, and that's the understanding of risk.
Right. So there's an equation we talk about, and I think this equation is intuitive to people when we talk about, you know, to get more return. People, I think, intuitively understand that that probably means you have to take on more risk, but they don't understand the equation of risk plus return equals the result that they get. Intuitively, we understand there's a relationship, Faisal, I would argue. Empirically, people chase return.
So let me paint the picture. For those of you who haven't come to one of our sessions, this is what we did this week at one of our seminars that we do every single month. We put up on the screen two portfolios,
yep.
Portfolio A, Portfolio B. Portfolio A, 10-year average return, 11.5%. Portfolio B, 10.5%, 10-year average rate of return.
Yeah. Which one would you take?
Which one would you take?
Right. Let me guess.
Everybody put their hands up for the 11.5.
I want more return. Makes sense, right?
So I'll tell you, I'll pause there for a second. What most Canadians do is they will chase the number as if that's the only part of the equation. Well, I want that 11.5%, not the 10.5%. Because it's more.
Yeah, but hang on a second. I'll play devil's advocate. At the end of the 10 years, I had more with portfolio A than portfolio B. I want that.
Correct. Okay, so that's the foundation of what people start with.
Okay.
Then on that screen, we put another metric underneath it. And we said, okay, portfolio A, which outperformed portfolio B over
that 10-year
the
period.
10-year yep. period, had twice the amount of volatility than if you were in portfolio B.
What does that mean?
So we said, if you look at the range of volatility of that portfolio, one of the leading portfolios in the industry today, over the last 10 years, you would have to accept over any 12-month period, 28% swing in the portfolio on the negative side as well.
Right.
On portfolio B, which had a less of a return,
yep.
the volatility on the downside was like 8.
Yeah.
Okay. So if you got $2 million and you want that 11.5% rate of return, $2 million could fall by $560,000. Portfolio B, which gives you less of a return, the downside was $160,000 at its worst performance.
Right.
Okay, which now do you prefer? And all of a sudden, everybody started to put up their hands for portfolio B,
right,
which had a lower return. In the absence of knowing the risk, return is the only thing we focus on.
Right.
And so we said, here is the mathematical equation you need to know going forward. Risk plus return equals the results you should expect.
Right, and then do those results match what you need? Right, and I'm going to say let's just move away for a second from just the mathematical result, because what happens emotionally, now I'm talking behavioral finance, when that $2 million falls by $560,000 to the average person, what happens? Do they stay in it and say, "Oh, that's part of it"?
Do they just go to sleep and wake up the next day and not look at their portfolio, not lose sleep, not cut their lifestyle, not change anything? That's the problem.
Right.
That's the problem. And I think that's where people need to get their minds around. And I'll tell you what's going to happen in 2023, Dave. There are going to be a lot of portfolios that say, look how great they've done, whatever time frame, and they're going to focus on the return. Here's what's interesting about Canadians, and I will probably throw Americans in this one too. When they look at growing their portfolio, they look in percent.
Oh, yes. Oh.
When people lose on their portfolio, they look in dollars.
Yeah, that's right.
So a client could say to you, I lost $50,000. Well, you have $5 million, that's 1%. But I lost $50,000.
Right.
That's a lot of money. And they're right.
And it's the next year they could say, I only made 1%.
Correct. It's the same thing.
You're so right about that.
So I think Canadians, and I'll throw in Americans there too, our American audience, they want to be part of this. Mm-hmm. When we look at risk, look at it in form of dollars.
Right.
When you look at return, look at in form of percent.
Right.
And does that match?
Right.
Does that equation make you feel comfortable?
Right.
Knowing what you've gone through and really look at yourself and say, can I handle a $560,000 drop? Very few people are comfortable with that.
But if you could, and you were prepared to go to sleep for 10 years and not look at your portfolio, you could have earned 1% more compounded average than on something with a lower risk, right?
Yeah, but which on a compounded basis is a large difference.
Can add up, that's right. Just nobody, not nobody, very few people can survive that down without making an emotional mistake, an emotional decision. And
Without impact. It may not just be an emotional reaction. It'd be an impact in some way.
Sorry, yeah, exactly right.
Because people right now are saying, well, can I retire? People are saying, do I have to go back to work?
Right.
How you build that portfolio to get the results you're needing.
Exactly right.
Step number one.
Yep.
Number two, what risk are you willing to take? And then are those results going to match who you are as an individual?
And as a family, whatever it might be, right?
And that's where it comes into play.
You got it.
Because if I could get 11%, 11.5%, like I was saying, and I didn't look at it for 10 years, I wouldn't care.
Right.
I have yet to meet a single investor. And if you're one of them, please reach out to us.
Yeah.
That you don't look at your portfolio for 10 years.
Right.
You have no idea. You just put it in there and you won't look at it for 10 years. I've yet to meet one person that does that.
That's correct.
Because if they look at it on the day where they're down $560,000, that's impact.
Yeah, that's impact for sure. Okay, so risk plus results equals return.
No, let's try all to. All the way around. Risk plus return equals the result that you can expect.
So let's talk about that equation and bringing it to life in terms of a full lifestyle and plan to make sure you can get through those periods of time and still do what you want to do.
Yeah, that's when we're going to talk about that. Our upcoming seminar, Tuesday, January 24th, 7 p.m., live at the Silver Springs Golf and Country Club. You need to register for this. So go to morethanmoneyradio.com.
And of course, at morethanmoneyradio.com, you can hear all of our past segments on this show that we've done. Please feel free to join us at any point and listen, sign up for our podcast as well. Thanks for tuning in to another edition of More Than Money. On behalf of Faisal and myself, Dave, we'll chat with you next week.
David Popowich and Faisal Carmelli are portfolio managers and investment advisors with CIBC Woodgundy in Calgary. The views of David Popowich and Faisal Carmelli do not necessarily reflect those of CIBC World Markets Inc. Clients are advised to seek advice regarding their particular circumstances from their personal tax and legal advisors. If you are currently a CIBC Woodgundy client, please contact your investment advisor. CIBC Woodgundy is a division of CIBC World Markets Inc., a subsidiary of CIBC and a member of the Canadian Investor Protection Fund and Investment Industry Regulatory Organization of Canada.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink. All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone, like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.